Blog Talk Radio.
We've got an exciting one for you tonight. A little bit later on, we'll be talking with a fantastic actor, like one of our greatest and most intense character actors, Mr. Ed Harris. We'll be chatting with him in a little bit. And then a little bit later on in the show, we will have a home entertainment update with our home entertainment correspondent, Arenada Diaz, and Nat Segalov, the author of Final Cuts, the last films of 50 great directors, will join us. And that will inspire a roundtable conversation on that very topic as well. Hey, guys.
Hey, how are you, man? What's up?
Not bad. Hey, you know, I've been watching, I watched a few movies on Netflix today, and they have a good collection of documentaries, a lot of which I haven't even heard of, and I'm crazy about documentaries, filmmaking documentaries. Mm-hmm. And I found this one, I don't quite understand the title. It doesn't have the best title. It's called Something's Gonna Live. I highly recommend you guys watch it. It follows, I think, something like six storyboard artists, art directors, cinematographers from old Hollywood. So you have Henry Bumstead, who worked for three or four times with Hitchcock. You have
he's one of the greatest.
Yeah, Robert Boyle, who worked with Hitchcock. You have
Conrad
Hall is in the film.
Oh my God,
Haskell Wexler. And they're all close friends. It's a close kind of tight knit community,
right?
And
wow.
They all kind of join together, and it tells their story. And obviously, you get a big chunk of Hollywood history in here. There's a big section where Robert Boyle teams up with someone else, a storyboard artist that worked on The Birds, and they go back to the real location, Bodega Bay, I think. And
yeah.
they find the schoolhouse. And they find all the little locations where they shot, and they see how much it's changed over the past 30, 40 years. And sadly, what it really does, it kind of makes a statement about the passage of time and how things change and memories. It's a very wistful kind of documentary. And in the course of making the movie, every single one of the people in the movie, the participants, die. Except for Haskell Wexler. It's very moving, and it's a great tribute to art forms in the film industry that aren't usually discussed.
We look back on films which were searching for essential truths, sometimes in abstract means.
I remember the first piece of film I shot, and how you could use it to tell stories about the human condition.
Because a picture is like a symphony. It builds up, goes down. You're the composer. You have complete control.
We are trying to be artful. And to being artful, you have to do things which are beyond reality.
This is the original model, the Martian machine, as used in the picture.
Well, Hitch loved to see these things. It shows that you're thinking about the person to give him character.
It seemed only the right thing to do is to have a little reunion before it's too late.
It sounds absolutely magnificent if it has those people in it. Bumstead has been working up with Clint Eastwood until the 2000s or so, and then. You know, Wexler is still doing.
That's right. He was 91 years old when he worked on Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. Then I watched the Laszlo and Vilmos documentary.
Oh, okay.
No, it's called No Subtitles Necessary. And
Laszlo
shows
I've heard of it. I haven't watched it, but I've heard of it. Yeah.
You need to check that one out, too. Another great filmmaking documentary. Laszlo Kovacs and Vilmos Zsigmond. Vilmos has been on our show. Laszlo has since passed. But they were very close friends in Hungary. And they, during a war, they escaped from Hungary. And they came to America and hit America right at the cusp of Hollywood changing from the old guard to the new
right.
generation in the late
mm-hmm.
60s.
Totally.
And they determined, like, the look of American cinema.
They did.
Laszlo through, most notably, Easy Rider. And then Vilmos came up with McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Close
right.
Third Kind. And a Deliverance, and you know, they both did such remarkable work. But it's really a story of their enduring friendship. They were closer than brothers, the two of them, throughout their lives. And it's a very touching, but also just like a great glimpse into 60s and 70s, particularly cinema that they did. It's amazing.
Wow, those are two great film, not only documentary recommendations, but just film recommendations.
So Conrad's wow. last movie, Conrad Hall's last movie that he photographed was Road to Perdition.
Which you
well,
want to ask for.
Yeah, that's a good way to go out. I mean, that's not, there are worse ways. I mean,
I think he passed
well, that
before
guy,
that movie even
that,
came out, right?
He did. He passed away, and his Oscar was posthumous. But, you know, that guy, every time he went out with a film, it was nominated for an Oscar.
Who shot Bound for Glory?
Oh,
That's Wexler.
Haskell Wexler. In fact, here's an interesting thing that many people don't know, but that was the first film to actually use the Steadicam.
Oh.
Yeah.
It wasn't The Shining. It wasn't even The Formula. It wasn't those things.
And I know that shot.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
The man who wrote those words was Woody Guthrie. His music has become as much a part of America as its mountains, its rivers, its forests, and its people. His life has touched all of our lives. This is his story.
There was an event in California, Bound for Glory screening, attended by David Carradine, who starred in it, and Haskell Wexler, who shot it. And I guess Carradine made a statement on stage where he said, you know, and I enjoy the look of the film, even though it looks like it was shot through a glass of milk. Because it's like it's a very kind of hazy, dreamy looking thing.
It is.
And Haskell took terrible offense to it, and so they fought on stage. And my understanding of that event was it was the most uncomfortable experience for the people out in the audience. It was like watching a train wreck.
Let me just say something about that movie. I just watched that movie about 2 weeks ago. And I said, oh, I just have to watch it, you know. First of all, it's a great movie. Anybody who dismisses that movie as being one of the Best Picture nominees of 1976, along with Network and Taxi Driver, All the President's Men, and Rocky, hasn't really seen it. It's really, really a great movie. And yes, it does look like it's shot through a glass of milk in the first half of it. Well, that's because the first half of it takes place in the plains where the Dust Bowl was taking place. If you were looking at something across the street, you couldn't see it clearly because the dust was in your way. And you can see in that movie where the cinematography changes in the last half of it when it gets away from the dusty part of it, you know.
Okay, if you like our show tonight, you can follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is Movie Geeks Unite. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Check out our official website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And we also have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Let's get to our first guest tonight. Four-time Academy Award nominee Ed Harris. Can you guys name me the four nominations?
Pollock.
Yes.
History of Violence.
Apollo 13.
Yes.
And is it the right stuff?
No.
No, you didn't get it? Okay. Did anyone get nominated acting-wise for that?
No.
Shepard?
Oh, Sam Shepard did.
That's okay, good. Well, I'm glad
Sam
someone
Shepard.
Did.
Let's see. Pollock, Apollo 13. Oh, my gosh.
Isn't it History of Violence? Didn't he get it for History of Violence?
No, it was William Hurt that got the nomination for
History of
Violence.
Oh, William Hurt, okay. All right.
I can't remember the other two.
Not the Sweet Dreams or Alamo Bay or?
No.
All good performances, by the way.
Oh, it was a terrific performance. He got nominated for The Truman Show.
The Truman Show, right.
He was a last-minute replacement of Dennis Hopper in that movie.
Right.
That would have been a different movie.
And then he was nominated for The Hours.
Oh,
really?
I forgot about that.
I forgot he was in that.
That guy just blows me away every time.
You talk
so
about
great.
Great performances, Jackknife with Robert De Niro.
I was thinking about that today. That's a good movie. Really good
Sweet
movie.
Sweet Dreams with Jessica Lange. State of Grace with Gary Oldman. The Abyss. I remember reading stories or interviews with him about The Abyss. And he said
he did not like making that movie. He did not like
making that movie. He's great in that movie.
He is really great
in that movie.
But he said that was such a pressure cooker situation shooting that movie that one day he was driving home from the set and he had to pull off on the side of the road and he just broke down and cried. He said the intensity of that shoot was just overwhelming.
It actually makes its way into the performance itself because, you know, the number one thing that I remember about that performance is him telling Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio to fight.
Where he's trying to resuscitate her, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great intense stuff. Glengarry Glen Ross. I mean,
everyone's great in that.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And then, of course, Pollock, which was his absolute passion. I always loved the movie, the Prime Gig, which is the kind of salesman movie he did with Vince Vaughn. That's a great movie. On and on and on. Great movies. His latest movie is called Phantom. It's an intense film that takes place on a Soviet submarine that could hold the fate of the world within its grasp. So it's a very intense, claustrophobic, character-driven movie. It's in theaters now, and it co-stars David Duchovny. And here is Ed to tell us all about that film and a whole lot more about the craft of acting.
Stop the drill, Captain.
Why? Because our orders require us to take tactical advantage of the testing opportunities that classified onboard equipment.
Captain, I need you to put us under that ship.
We have men below.
Then you should get them out.
Scott, we have a problem in battery deck 2.
Yeah, what is it?
Not sure, sir. The men are coming up now.
Mr. Kozlov, terminate the drill.
Aye, sir. All hands, terminate drill. Captain,
what?
Put us under that ship.
Sir, we don't know who that is. Mr. Babinow, plot an intercept for that ship. Put the moon on our stern.
Aye, Captain.
Sir. Level the boat. Make our depth 10 meters.
Level the boat. Depth 10 meters.
Aye, aye. Level the boat. 10 meters.
Take a look before we get any closer. If that's all right with you.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Mr. Harris. How are you, sir?
I'm good.
I appreciate the time very much. I'm a big admirer of your work, so thank you so much.
Welcome. How's Movie Geeks going?
Movie Geeks is going very well. And speaking of geeking out on movies, I really liked yours. I thought it was incredibly intense and effective.
Good.
And I guess to start out with, I'm curious, when you read the script, what were the challenges associated with your character that most appealed to you?
Well, let's see. The challenges that were the most apparent to me were, what the hell is he talking about half the time?
yeah.
And what appealed to me was his you know, this guy who has this kind of, you see, this burden that he's carrying with him, not only his dad having been this big shot in the, you know, in terms of writing the book on Russian submarine warfare, but this incident that had happened earlier in his career that has affected him both physically and psychologically over the years and professionally, you know, and how he was dealing with that. I also appreciated his friendship with the character that William Fichtner played. So yeah, but the main challenge to me was like just. I didn't really know anything about submarines, how they operated or anything. So, you know, doing my research along those lines and getting familiar with what I was talking about half the time.
Well, you've done such a beautiful honor to your profession with your work over the years. And so it's obvious that you know how to recognize a well-rounded character on the page. But for the layperson, how do you go about that? Is it looking at it, and any question you have about your character is answered in the text? Is that how you recognize it?
Possibly, or if the unanswered questions are interesting ones that you are excited about filling in for yourself. It's really an instinctive kind of thing, I think, more or less. Plus a script can be a really good story and not be well written. And then you're going, yeah, this is a good story, but these words, nobody talks like this, or, God, it's set up, it's structured poorly, or, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
there's a lot of things going on when you're reading the script in terms of the feel of it and just how you can see it being translated onto the screen cinematically and who the director is and all kinds of stuff, you know.
Absolutely. You know, because I always hear the phrase, it's the most important thing to ask the question and maybe not even know the answer, but as long as you ask the question. And I haven't always been 100% certain what exactly that means.
Well, I'm not either. I mean, I think some questions need to be answered in terms of playing a character, for sure. But you have to know what questions to ask yourself to begin with, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, my daughter's 19 years old, so let's say she's having a problem about something. Instead of giving her answers, you know, maybe I'll ask her questions about what's going on with her. And she can think about them, answer them for herself if she cares to. So a director is more doing that, I think, with character than he is answering things.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, here's a character, why is he this way? Or what, fill in the blanks here, you know, what was his relationship with his father? What does he really feel about what happened when he had this accident and he had to sacrifice the lives of, you know, a number of his crewmen? I mean, how does that affect him? Obviously, on the page, you know he's been affected by it and thinks about it, but internally, how are you going to, you know, how are you going to deal with that?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of hard to talk about, but
In terms of playing scenes and playing these moments, I mean, this is a very intense claustrophobic piece, and there are a lot of great scenes with your fellow actors. And movies, by their nature, are very kind of stop and start. I mean, you work on moments. Were you able to achieve kind of a rhythm where you were able to let a scene breathe and not so much stop and start?
First of all, we were shooting, you know, we shot the whole film in 21 days, so we were filming a lot every day. It was not a lot of waiting around, you know, so that was really good because you were always involved during the day with your character and what was happening. So, you know, I mean, any given scene, we would work it in terms of the flow of it, in terms of the rhythm of working. It kind of seemed to take care of itself because we were always, you know, involved. And you become so familiar with the story and what happens when this is with this tanker, this is with this Russian sub, this is when he does the Phantom thing, blah, 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 blah. You know, so whether you're shooting in sequence or not, you're aware of where you are in the story, you know, what's being called upon for your character to do.
When you look at the movie now, and I would imagine you've seen the movie, correct?
Well, I just really saw it once, and not in a big theater. I mean, I saw it. It was a screening room. It was a fairly good sized screen, but I was kind of close to it. It was close physically to the screen. Mm. Didn't really have a perspective on it. So, kind of looking forward to it. They're screening it tomorrow night at the, you know, big man's Chinese theater here in Hollywood. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing it on a big screen with some distance.
Yeah.
But I think it works. I mean, I'm really proud of Todd, you know. It was this idea he'd been working on for a couple of years, and he pulled it off.
And it was shot on a real submarine?
Yeah, it was shot on a Russian sub that's in San Diego, part of a naval museum down there. It's in the water, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's not... It can't be submerged, but it's in the water, and we shot 98% of the movie in that sub.
Wow.
And it's not very big.
But it must have been, I mean, that must have done a lot of work for you.
Well, definitely. It was great shooting in there. I mean, can you imagine shooting in a real sub as opposed to, okay, now we're on a sound stage in Burbank, you know.
Right.
And here's your set for the sub. It's like, yeah, no. Sorry.
Well, I wanted to ask you, too, about your directing, because I've loved the films that you've directed.
Yeah, well, I hope there's another one in there.
I do, too.
Soon.
I'm curious about that, because when you, I mean, you have to be so passionate to direct a film about and invested in the material you're working
right,
on.
Right, exactly.
So when you go from that, being kind of in charge of the whole pie, to just being an actor and being in charge of your slice, really, is that a tough adjustment?
It's a huge letdown. Well, it's not really like a letdown. It's just really different. I love the two experiences I've had directing. I've really enjoyed them, as hard as they may have been, particularly the Pollock thing, but... I really want to direct more. It's just like you said, it has to touch something so deep in me. I have to, you know, and I haven't found that thing that I want to commit myself to spending that kind of time with. Mm. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself a filmmaker as much as I do someone who, when he finds something, wants to make a film out of, he does it.
Jackson Pollock, I'm Lee Krasner. I thought I knew all the abstract artists in New York, and I don't know Jackson Pollock.
What do you think of the cops? So.
Yeah, how's it been?
De Kooning.
He's all right. He's learning.
What's she doing here?
You need to get cleaned up.
I have just climbed up and down 5 flights of stairs. I'm Peggy Guggenheim.
They're sorry.
My God, and you're drunk.
No.
No.
What you're doing is the most original and vigorous art in the country.
We're broke.
You just keep at it.
I'm keeping at it. Don't tell me to keep at it.
We spoke, I believe it was upon Appaloosa's release. We did a long conversation with Jeff Beal, because we're crazy about film composition on the show,
right.
too. And
right.
he, one of our favorite conversations, and actually that was my favorite score that year. So we've been big cheerleaders for your directorial work for a while.
All right, well, hopefully I can get one going here in the next year or two.
Yeah.
Speaking of music, you know, Rona did... really interesting. There's a thing on YouTube, Jeff Rona. If you look up Jeff Rona, whatever, dash, Phantom, there's a little piece that somebody did of him talking about how he did the music for this film. Because he went in that sub and, like, recorded all these sounds, clinking sounds. You know, he's knocking on all these different kinds of things and getting all these different sounds that he kind of, you know, put into the mix and computerized and changed around. It was kind of cool.
I saw that. That was a beautiful experiment. Last question that I'll ask you, because I know you're pressed for time, but I'm curious, since you've been doing this for so long, if acting means something different to you now than it did when you first started.
Well, I don't know if it means something different to me. You know, I don't know. I like to think, you know, something that you just keep working at and growing with. So probably maybe a little more relaxed with it than I used to be in some level. But I don't really know. I mean, I still enjoy it. You know, I actually really enjoy doing theater. I hope to be doing this play in New York in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And So I still do enjoy it.
Do you feel that your process is simplified now from where it was when it started?
I just think there's less tension about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I understand what I need to do better. I don't do more than I need to do. I do what I need to do what I have to do. I don't waste energy doing it, which doesn't mean I won't spend energy, but I just have, I think, a certain amount of confidence and trust myself in terms of preparation, that kind of thing. And the act of doing it, you know, on the camera, in front of the camera is, you know, it's just, you just keep trying to keep probing the truth and, you know, finding ways to keep things interesting.
Mm-hmm. And what's the play you're doing next? You said you're
well, it's a new Beth Henley play called The Jacksonian that we did here, Amy, my wife, and I, and Bill Pullman.
Right.
And
yeah.
Ben Hedley, we did it at the Geffen. I think we're going to do it in New York in the fall at the Acorn Theater.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah,
that would be great.
Looking forward to it. Excited about that.
Well, I appreciate your time very much, and thank you for all the great work. It means a lot to me.
Well, you're welcome, Jamie. Hope I can keep doing it for you for a number of years.
I'm as political officer on this boat as your friend. It's my duty to tell you that if you even imply treasonous intent of elite KGB officers without proper evidence or cause, you will be put up for charges of misconduct of the code of military justice.
Sometimes a man has to pick a side, Greg.
Well, then you should pick wisely. Because if you're wrong, this will haunt you and your families for the rest of your lives. No matter who your father is.
All right, that was Ed Harris. The movie is called Phantom. It opens in limited release this weekend. It's already out there in theaters, so check it out, especially if when it expands in future weeks to more theaters. Okay, now we turn our spotlight on the home entertainment offerings of the month. And to help me do that is our home entertainment correspondent, Aaron Ada Diaz. We got together earlier this weekend to discuss a couple of the latest titles we've gotten our hands on Blu-ray and DVD. And here is our conversation. Frankenweenie.
Obviously beautiful on Blu-ray. I actually thought if Brave wasn't going to win, Frankenweenie would win Best Animated Film.
I did too.
Just because, you know, black and white and so forth, it was kind of the most different of all the other animated films.
What about that dog of yours?
She's not in the house and she's away from your tulips.
I want you to remember something. While your parents are away, I am in charge here.
Yes, Uncle Bob.
The typical features, you know, kind of the behind-the-scenes stuff, storyboards and previs and visualizing and all that stuff. So, I mean, it's got a kind of a nice package of extras. The highlight is the transfer, obviously.
To allow, to give over, to accept that when you are in processing, what comes to you is always right. Always right. Always good. Always helpful. Will always lead you toward the pain.
The sea doors. And we walk. She wrote me a letter. No one else wrote me a letter. She wrote me a letter.
And then there's The Master that's now available on DVD and Blu-ray and VOD. It is a good transfer, and it's actually the extras on the disc are as kind of obtuse as you would expect them to be for this particular movie. there's a little thing of outtakes in there, which are imaginatively edited together. But really, there's a very interesting documentary that John Huston made on World War II veterans and PTSD that It's like almost an hour long, and it's a major source of inspiration for P.T. Anderson when he put together The Master, at least Freddie Quell's story. So that's included on the disc, too.
I consider this package to be a step above There Will Be Blood. I think There Will Be Blood is very, very skimpy, and also it's not a very good transfer. It's not as good as it should be, There Will Be Blood, on DVD or Blu-ray.
So 20th Century Fox is coming out with a new Cleopatra. I think it's its first time on Blu-ray.
In attaining her objectives, Cleopatra has been known to employ torture, poison, and even her own sexual talents, which are said to be considerable.
And it's got a lot of extras on it. It's got a pretty, pretty in-depth commentary, but it also has never-before-seen behind-the-scenes footage, apparently. It's hard to believe that they were still able to unearth stuff that they've never released in the vaults for Cleopatra.
It cost
$42 million to make, which is equivalent to over $300 million today. It only grossed $24 million back in its initial release.
Mm-hmm.
But all told, special features and movie, all told, all together, in these two Blu-ray discs that are part of the package, 561 minutes of content. So you get your money's worth, if you like Cleopatra.
Her perfect pale skin, her Tudor court face, her strong, fleshy legs drove me to ecstasies of despair. All I wished for were hands that moved, just to touch her.
There's also the Sessions that 20th Century Fox has come out with. And the Sessions, of course, they got one Oscar nomination for Helen Hunt. And a lot of people consider John Hawkes a snub for Best Actor in there. But it's out on Blu-ray and DVD and video on demand. And it's available for a lot of people to see that didn't possibly catch it in the theaters. The extras on it are a few deleted scenes and kind of like interviews with the cast.
I had heard, Helen Hunt got one Oscar nomination, but she got two Golden Globes.
Country,
England.
Gun,
shot.
Agent,
provocateur.
Murder,
employment.
Skyfall. Skyfall.
Done.
And then there's Skyfall.
Terrific movie, one of the better Bonds. One of the better Bond films, really celebrates Bond, kind of brings these first three Daniel Craig ones to a close and sets it up for a new stretch of vehicles for Daniel Craig. Maybe something a little more playful, a little more, you know, a little lighter.
Well, this is a beautiful transfer. It's really well done. And the it's kind of a long documentary about every aspect of the making of it and the kind of the traditions of Bond and how this plays into those traditions. And it has two commentaries, one from Mendez and the others from the producers of the film.
Oh, Broccoli and Wilson.
Wilson, yeah. Criterion recently came out with, last month they came out with On the Waterfront. Now, was Waterfront a DVD title of Criterion's? I don't think it was.
Yes, it was.
Oh, was it?
It was, there was Criterion.
Well, this has an audio commentary by Richard Schickel and Jeff Young, and it has a new conversation between Martin Scorsese and critic Kent Jones in it as well, and a lot of extra information and interviews and documentaries about Ilya Kazan, and there's a new interview with a lot of people, actually, Eva Marie Saint included.
Yeah, I mean, this was kind of their showpiece released last month. They've always had one title every now and then that kind of defines the month, and all the other titles around it are kind of a little more in a minor key. This On the Waterfront was kind of the biggie for the month.
And they have some good stuff coming up, Criterion. They have the original The Blob. All Blu-ray, yeah. Badlands. Which is the one that I'm absolutely most looking forward to. With a transfer approved by Terrence Malick. So I'm wondering, like, does Malick come to them, or do they mail something to him and he looks at it, or?
I don't know. It might be time we should try to see if we can get one of the Criterion executives, particularly to talk about that film.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. We need to find out who produced that thing and bring him on. Because I want to know if Malik, the recluse, like walked in the Criterion offices and took a look at what they were doing.
He was 25 years old. He combed his hair like James Dean. He was very fastidious. People who littered bothered him. She was 15. She took music lessons and could twirl a baton.
I'm Kit. I'm not keeping you from anything important, am I?
No.
She wasn't very popular at school. For a while, they lived together in a treehouse. In 1959, they murdered a lot of people.
The special feature I'm most looking forward to on Badlands is a new documentary with Spacek and Martin Sheen and Jack Fisk. I mean, if you think about the ways to do a movie like Badlands, you know the stereotypical way to do that. Serial murderers on a cross-country spree. But then, I mean, Malick did it in his typical, but we didn't know it was typical then, lyrical style, and it just gave it this haunting, transcendent quality that we're certainly not used to seeing in that genre of film.
Well, he does a lot to take the romance out of that is usually part and parcel with that, you know, lovers on the run type thing. He really gets he taps into more of the detachment and kind of the banal, you know, grind of the behavior, you know, the banality of the behavior that, you know, yeah, these kids are doing something, but they're kind of affectedless. There's no real emotional, you know, response from what they're doing.
Okay, thank you, Aaron. That was just a brief lineup of what's available out there now and what's yet to come on DVD and Blu-ray. Some good titles, especially from Criterion this upcoming month. I know, Dean, you're really excited about Mike Lee's Life is Sweet coming around the corner.
Oh, my God, because it hasn't been available. I mean, nobody's been able to see it since it was on VHS in 1991 or whatever. So
right. It used to be on when Bravo showed movies. It used to be on Bravo.
Yeah, when everything wasn't Real Housewives. Yeah.
I mean, but Life is Sweet, I mean, if I was going to pick one movie that should be on Criterion, well, I would pick two movies. It would be Life is Sweet, and then the next one would be Chili Soup the Winner from 1979, which is a very difficult movie for them to get, I believe, because it's from MGM. So.
Okay, Nat Segalov is here. We had him on last year to talk about his last book, which was a great biography of Arthur Penn. He's a tremendous film lover and a great writer, and he's picked a heck of a topic for his latest book. It's called Final Cuts, The Last Films of 50 Great Directors. It's available now. You can purchase it from our show page right here, and we just talk a little bit about some of the directors he chose to feature in his book. This topic has actually been has kind of made movie headlines lately because of a statement that Tarantino made that he wants to retire early because he didn't want to become like so many great directors who go out with a whimper with their last films. Do you think that's a fair generalization?
No. But I'm surprised that came from Tarantino, who has about as deep a knowledge of film as anybody who's ever lived. It's about 50-50, I found, and certainly I think he should keep on going. A director isn't always the one who has control over his own films, and you like to think as somebody gets older, they have more control because people leave them alone. But in fact, at a certain age, the younger people in the studio start interfering, and that's what happens. Half the directors in the book made films which are just unfortunate, shall we say, and the other half made movies that are pretty good. They just had the misfortune to die afterwards.
It is an interesting thing, though, because and I think that all of the creative artists in all the disciplines kind of suffer from this or have to grapple with this. The struggle to stay relevant. And when you look at the directors that you profiled, who's the shining example of that for you?
Well, God, I'm probably saying this to the wrong person, but I think Kubrick Stanley Cooper is an example of somebody who may have stayed too long at the circus. And the film that he made as his last film, Eyes Wide Shut, really needs the backstory of AI, artificial intelligence, which was a film that he realized he couldn't make because the technology wasn't ready for it yet. But as another director friend of mine said, there's a reason Stanley didn't make that movie, and that it didn't work, and even the technology wouldn't have helped him. Whether Spielberg solved the problems, I think, is anybody's guess. I know the great British critic Mark Kermode has just done a broadcast apology for not liking AI when it came out, and now he does. I still don't particularly care for it. But Kubrick is someone whose reach always exceeded his grasp, and then he pulled the grasp up to meet it. He always advanced film technology, which is why he was one of the maybe dozen greatest filmmakers who ever lived. But Eyes Wide Shut was made by a guy who doesn't get out much. As usual, he lost the humanity in his films, and he didn't have the technology to make up for it.
So you think that Eyes Wide Shut is a pretty naive movie?
I think very much naive, which is interesting for a man who knows everything academically about people but doesn't really know them emotionally, at least how to achieve that on screen.
Were there, I mean, there's those directors that kind of stick by their guns and you recognize their strengths and they always play to them. But then there are also directors that aren't afraid to work outside of their comfort zone, which is particularly brave when you're that late in your career. What are examples of those types of filmmakers for you? Because I'm thinking, looking at somebody like Sidney Lumet, who made a lot of great, gritty character films. But Before the Devil Knows You're Dead was, to be a last film, that was kind of a very amoral tale. You know.
Well, but that was, I mean, look at Prince of the City, or look about Dog Day Afternoon, and Lumet was always trying to show the immorality lying just below the surface of our morality. In fact, all directors like to see that all art is about taking the expected and showing us the unexpected twist on it. With Lumet, you think it's an uncharacteristically violent film for him. But, you know, Lumet, I mean, tried everything and made so many movies. Most of them hit, some of them didn't. But Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is just an extraordinary confluence of his wisdom in changing the way it was written and of hiring the right actors and of making it absolutely perfect. But he didn't plan on it being his last film. He still had like three of them in pre-production. So I don't know if that would be considered late in his game. To him, it was a normal part of the game.
When you met me, my biggest prospect was inheriting a mom-and-pop jewelry store in a fucking shopping mall in Westchester. Now, I know it's not Trump Plaza, but just take a look at how we're living now. And I took that lousy job in that real estate office. I was practically a fucking gopher, and I'm pulling down six figures now. I'm smart. I know the angles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet you do.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
Well, because there's no extradition agreement between Brazil and the United States.
How the hell do you know that?
I saw it in the movie.
Yeah, I guess I saw the same movie.
And I'm sure a lot of it has to do with opportunity, too, because I'm sure for the older generations it got a lot harder to finance certain films. And the great material wasn't there as much as it might have been for them at the beginning of their careers. And I think the most extreme example of this would probably be Orson Welles, who started his career by making the greatest film of all time, which eventually kind of ruined him.
Yes.
Anyway, I mean, it's the great tragic story of Hollywood for me.
It's true. Welles could do anything, and he usually did it with less opportunity than anybody who had that much talent should have to suffer. But he himself said, you know, I don't think Hollywood treated me badly, not the way they treated people like Buster Keaton and D.W. Griffith and others. So he was rather magnanimous. But Welles was always reinventing himself because he had to learn to live on a budget, whether it was shooting Othello over, 8 years or something by doing a pickup shot in Morocco and doing another shot in France, and they miraculously all came together. He was someone who, with his last film, F for Fake, and this is something we explore in Final Cuts, he invented reality television, as far as I'm concerned, because he completely fabricated something which we absolutely believe, and he used real people to do it.
For my next experiment, ladies and gentlemen, I would appreciate the loan of any small personal object from your pocket, a key, a box of matches, a coin.
Here it is. Good, sir. Hold it up 10 feet over your head and watch out for the slightest hint of hanky-panky. And behold, before our very eyes, a transformation. We've changed your key into a coin. What happened to the key? It's been returned to you. Look closely, sir. You'll find the key back in your pocket. May we see it, please?
What was the most surprising discovery for you when you visited these last films?
Oh, my goodness. I wasn't expecting that question. I think the most surprising discovery for me was to realize how a film can be taken away from a director who you think would be able to hold on to it tightly. Michael Ritchie is an example of that, whose last film, A Simple Wish, about a fairy godfather, looks like a demo reel for a CGI company, more than the sort of tight directing that Michael was able to do. This is the man who, after all, made The Candidate and made Smile, which is one of the great little movies. And as he said, you only make the movies they let you make, but A Simple Wish looks like a comeback for him. It has some terrific performances and a really awful script. And I think that's something that, really got away from him.
Well, and I'm thinking about those kind of, those self-destructive artists, too. Somebody like Sam Peckinpah, who's just complete, has made such completely brilliant movies, but he was, he didn't kind of endear himself to the system. And I think he played that out in his movies in kind of subverted ways, I think, that struggle.
That's true. When he was in fully control of everything, he was able to stick little things in there. But you're right, Sam was his own worst enemy, except when Hollywood was concerned. And his career reminds me of an old wisecrack that Peter Fonda had. Somebody said, well, if you're such a rebel, how come you make movies in Hollywood? And Peter Fonda said, it's because they have all the cameras. Well, of course, that isn't true anymore, but it was for Sam Peckinpah. And when he was indulged, after he'd had a hit, people wanted to work with him, people wanted to see the name Sam Peckinpah. And in fact, there's evidence of a lawsuit in the Osterman Weekend when people were going around selling a film as a Sam Peckinpah film when he hadn't given permission to have his name used yet. So he was a brand name, and he managed to embellish that brand name. At the same time, he also had to live up to it, just like Orson Welles. And Sam wasn't capable of living up to it because of the drugs and because of the booze.
I dare say you are wondering why I am floating around London like this. I am on the famous Thames River, investigating a murder. Rivers can be very sinister places. And in my new film, Frenzy, this river, you may say, was the scene of a very horrible murder.
Whenever I think about the struggle to stay relevant, I always think of Hitchcock, because when you've set a standard, as Hitchcock did, and a future generation of filmmakers all follow in your footsteps, you run the risk of that future generation beating you at your own game. Do you think that happened to Hitchcock?
I think so, which is interesting. You mentioned Frenzy, as we have been, because it was the first R-rated Hitchcock film. Because it involves sexual matters that were actually out there. The character of Mr. Rusk actually had an orgasm on camera, although you didn't see it. You saw his facial expression. I mean, Hitchcock would have made that dirty joke on a party, but he certainly wouldn't have ever put it on the screen. And that was the beginning of the frankness. When Hitch does it, everybody does it. But he was someone who had created his own screen vocabulary and then found everybody else using it. So it's a strange conundrum. De Palma has taken what Hitchcock did and added so many variations that I think he's really created his own language, or a sub-language, if you will, and in a beautifully flamboyant way that Hitchcock never would have dared attempt.
James Bridges. Was Bright Lights, Big City his last film? Was that his last film?
Yes, it was.
The Post
is the most shameful of your several addictions. You're a secret fan of killer bees, hero cops, sex fiends, lottery winners, teenage terrorists, Liz Taylor, tough tots, sicko creeps, living nightmares, life on other planets, spontaneous human combustion, coma babies.
Jim was a very close friend, and it was really tough to write about him.
What does that film say about him? How does that reflect his personality as you knew it?
Not at all. Mm. He didn't do drugs, and he wasn't a carouser, but he took the film over after another filmmaker had been fired, and Jim, true to his honor, wouldn't take it over unless she actually was fired. He wasn't going to look at her footage, not a frame of it, until the film company made the decision. He came in and literally rewrote the script in a matter of days, and they kept everybody on salary and didn't fire anybody, which was also unusual. And he took it over and wrestled it to the ground as much as he could, and then it was undone by the focus groups.
Do you not enjoy that movie at all? Do you not see much value in that film as it is now?
I knew what he wanted to put into it, and so I see pieces of value. It's like looking at a beautiful painting through a louver instead of looking at the painting itself. It kept to his values, and he has terrific performances. I don't think the film served itself well, but it wasn't Jim's fault.
Yeah. Somebody like John Huston, his last film being The Dead, correct?
Yes.
That was his last
yes.
film? Which
yes.
Which seems like a very fitting, proper swan song for him.
Gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous film.
Yeah,
it still works. I watched it again in writing Final Cuts. It has a power because, of course, it comes from one of the great source materials in the English language. But it's also done with great restraint, and it really isn't a story. You know, it's a novella. It's just two people at a party, and the woman comes home and thinks. That's all it is. But the way it works, and using someone, you know, wonderful like Angelica Huston, and all the ensemble really brings that moment alive, and you begin to go back in time, and you think, but it was 100 years ago, when in fact it was filmed in a warehouse in Valencia, California.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, I remember
Houston.
Being at, I was in art school, and as a high schooler, and our acting teacher showed us The Dead, and it was remarkable, and it wasn't. When did he pass? When was The Dead?
It was 87. 87 that Huston died. I covered the story because he was working on a film for his son, Danny, who's now become a marvelous actor, but at
yeah.
the time he wanted to be a director. He was doing an adaptation of a book by Thornton Wilder called Theophilus North. It was released under the title of Mr. North. And Robert Mitchum and Lauren Bacall and Tammy Grimes, David Warner, I mean, everybody you ever wanted to have dinner with was there. To be with John Huston.
Mm. When you started planning your book, and I'm sure you listed many directors that were worthy of exploration, what were some of those names that you either couldn't fit for length constraints, or you just their stories kind of didn't mesh with the other ones that you told?
It was actually more utilitarian than that, but let me go back and say the ones that I put in Final Cut were those who had to be dead, which is a very tough requirement for people to meet. I have some candidates right now for a sequel, but that's another story. First, they had to be dead. Then they had to have had a large enough body of work that I could write about something. You know, someone like Steve Gordon, who made the wonderful comedy Arthur, died after his first film, and who knows what he could have made, but not enough to write about. And it had to be theatrical features because they had to fight the system. So someone like Ida Lupino, who was a marvelous director in the 40s, wound up doing television, and that wasn't interesting enough. Third, they had to be enough information about their last film so that I could actually research it. You know, something that came out in the late 20s or in the 30s wasn't going to work if there's no production records, no files, no materials. And the fourth thing was I had to actually like their work.
Mm.
The last one was the most controversial, perhaps, because there are people in here who you wouldn't normally think would be a great director. But because I interviewed so many people, I started a number of years ago, I wanted to make sure that I had some material or knew them or had some affinity. So in many cases, there were interviews that had never been published anywhere that I conducted with Peter Yates or Michael Ritchie or James Bridges. And those found their way into the book. So the directors that I, it's a long answer, the directors I wish I had put in were people like Sidney Pollack, who I like personally very much. I love his films, but his last film, The Interpreter, wasn't very good. Some of the early directors I had trouble with because there simply aren't records. The studios closed down their ranks and we couldn't get anything about them.
Well, but you do have people like Raoul Walsh,
yes.
and Griffith and Hawks and Kazan. And Raoul Walsh, I read a biography on him not too long ago, maybe a year, year and a half ago. Somebody that made hundreds of films.
Oh, yeah. No one knows how many he made.
Yeah, it's an incredible contribution that he made to cinema, and he's not talked about very often, I don't think.
He slipped through the fingers, I think. I mean, you have wonderful historians like Dick Schickel and Peter Bogdanovich who did major, major works on them. And, of course, Walsh had his own autobiography. But we just don't see his films as often as we should, and he made one of each, and it was a success in all of them.
And
even his last film has some good stuff in it.
And his last film, refresh my memory, what was this?
His last film was A Distant Trumpet. It was a kind of a tired old cavalry tale, but there's some wonderful byplay and some wonderful just touches in the sense of how people talk to each other, how they relate to each other. But he was undone because he was using a widescreen process, and he didn't go in for enough close-ups. Maybe they didn't have the money, who knows. So when you see the film on video, you literally can't tell who's who. And that's a problem when you're trying to follow a story. But it's an elegant film, your basic Western, and, you know, I think he did it for the money. He wasn't very well during it, but, you know, who was?
Well, one of the filmmakers that you profile is actually, it goes back to my first question, which involved Tarantino's observation. When he talked about not wanting to be the old director who's irrelevant and goes out with a whimper, he used the example of Billy Wilder.
Oh, God. Oh,
yeah.
God.
Is that a sad conclusion for you? Or?
It was. This is a man who made maybe six of the greatest movies ever made. And as he once said, after a couple of flops in early, said, look, I made Sunset Boulevard, I made Lost Weekend, I made Something Like It Hot, The Fortune Cookie. I didn't suddenly get stupid.
Right. Right.
And it just, you know, Buddy had everything going wrong with it. But, I mean, God knows he had enough money. I don't know why he made it, except he wanted to make films. He joined the process of making films. But
That's a problem, too. I mean, you know, you could wait around forever to find the right material, but if you're a filmmaker, it essentially comes down to you want to work. You want to make films. So you
have that's
to
what
cut,
you do.
Yeah.
And it comes to a point when, I don't know if you bleep or not, but a filmmaker says, I'm tired of putting up with all this shit.
Yeah.
And you just bow out. You don't want to do it. A lot of great directors of photography do their best work in commercials because they're tired of working in movies. And some directors will do a television commercial or an internet commercial because they don't want to deal with the studio bosses, and they can have their own way with them doing a commercial. John Milius had a big thing about heroes, and I'm going to use this as an example. He said, the best hero leaves before he becomes old and decrepit so people can have the memory of when he was strong. The last thing you want is for a hero of yours to be withering away in front of you. They only get to make the movies they let you make. You know, when you think about the movies that people tried to do for years and years and it didn't work, and then they hand you, well, you can make this if you make that. I mean, that was the case of William Wellman. They wanted him to make Darby's Rangers, and he wanted to make Lafayette Escadrille.
Mm-hmm.
And he made them both, and then Jack Warner, the SOB, made sure that he would release Darby's Rangers first and held the post-production of Lafayette Escapee for ransom, even to the point of making them shoot a new ending.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even if you try to play the game, they get you.
Well, and then there are some directors, and I think Peckinpah is a prime example. I was reading a criticism of The Killer Elite that Pauline Kael wrote, and she said, look, even when he does studio Drek, he can't help but make it autobiographical in some way. Do you find with a lot of these directors in their last films that even if it's subverted in some way, they're kind of grappling with the aging process or nearing the end? I mean, do you see that in some of these works?
Maybe John Ford. not Seven Women, but Young Cassidy, I think. And certainly Wellman. Let me think. I don't think Howard Hawks was. I think he was so closed and cold personally. I don't think anything he made was a personal movie, except some of the ethics in it. But as far as story points, it's hard to really see that. I think if these guys hadn't made their swan song by then, they never were going to.
Well, they weren't outside of Houston, I'm sure they weren't expecting it necessarily to be their last film, like you said before.
I think that's the case. Joe Mankiewicz did a wonderful job on Sleuth, but I don't believe that's a film he wanted to be remembered by.
Okay, that was Nat Segeloff. The book is Final Cuts, The Last Films of 50 Great Directors. Pick it up now. It's highly recommended. It's important to keep in mind that by far most of these directors didn't intend for their last films to actually be their last film. I mean, no one thinks they're going to die.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the propensity is for us to look for something deeper, look for something that says something definitive about nearing death or something, you know. But that's not the case for most of these filmmakers, I wouldn't think.
Well, let me start with something very recent, unexpected, Tony Scott.
Well, yes, Unstoppable.
Unstoppable, which is actually, you know, I was thinking, so it's
such an ironically titled movie now.
I know, yeah. But it's actually a very enjoyable, really great action film, something that he was really great at. And I don't know, now, was he working, or was he thinking, was it Top Gun 2 really going to happen?
Top Gun 2, he was scouting locations with Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise was with him just the day before, I think.
Right, okay.
He went to one of the bases. he was with him.
Yeah. Okay. No, because that's a. I mean, look, it's not like you said. It's, you know, it was for at least for us, it was unexpected. And if you're going to look at that as the last film, Unstoppable, that is an. I think, given the films that he made,
it's actually quite a great last film.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a really good movie.
I think it was a good movie for him. I mean, he mm-hmm. did a lot of movies with mixed results, but even when they weren't great,
they were Tony Scott films.
Yeah, the unmistakable Tony Scott style.
Yeah.
You either hated it or you were turned on by it. I mean, a lot of times I thought it was too much.
Right.
Then I'd look at it and say, you know, but then again, I mean, he's reaching. I mean, these are, at their very core, they're highly commercial films that
right.
are extremely experimental. And I think that very few directors experimented as much as Tony Scott with the visual language.
Well, look at Domino. Domino is like full. I mean, he doesn't even know what he wants to do in Domino.
What happens?
I don't know. I was just making pictures.
What was the nickel for?
Jane, what was the nickel for?
The nickel was for the movies.
Ilya Kazan's The Last Tycoon from 76.
What do you pay me for? I don't understand the damn stuff.
Yes, you do. Or you wouldn't have asked about the nickel.
Robert De Niro nominally playing Thalberg. It's a incomplete screenplay. It's a screenplay based on an incomplete story by F. Scott Fitzgerald. It's got a great supporting cast. It's not completely successful, but it is a very, very interesting final film from Kazan. And it's very interesting because it has De Niro in the lead.
Yeah, and it's a great opportunity, too, to see De Niro and Nicholson share the screen together.
Exactly.
You know, and also, it's so ironic that we're bringing up Kazan when Ann Harris is on the show, because I remember vividly when De Niro and Scorsese presented Kazan with the honorary Oscar, whatever year that was. And it was very controversial, and there are a lot of people standing up to clap, and then there are a lot of people that were staying seated. And Ed Harris was one that would not stand up and clap for him.
Right, I remember that.
He had a very intense expression on his face, like he was not in
the... I remember that.
Yeah.
Okay, so my next one is Martin Ritt's last movie, also with Robert De Niro and with Jane Fonda,
yeah.
Alien Iris. Was my
oh yeah.
Mm. And I know that our guest talks about that film as well.
Yeah, Martin Ritt's in his book, and he was friends with Martin Ritt. That's an interesting movie. That's the movie where De Niro is dyslexic, or
yeah,
he's illiterate.
Yeah.
He's illiterate. And
right.
Jane Fonda teaches him to read, and they kind of start an affair. And also, I still own the musical score for that. John Williams did the score
wow.
for that. And I remember vividly a conversation that he has under a tree with a kid, where the kid talks about De Niro's father just died, and the kid's
yeah.
talking about when he gets scared, he likes to turn on the light and leave the light on at night. And De Niro makes a comment like, "My father was my light." And that's one of those movie conversations that have always stuck with me, that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Martin Ritt was really great at, like, you know, people don't talk about Martin Ritt as being one of the great directors, but he was really terrific at getting into the heart of what all kinds of people are thinking and feeling at certain moments. You know, I mean, when you think about Conrack or HUD or Sounder,
right.
I mean, those are all great, like, little people movies, you know, and
right.
those are my favorite kinds of movies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Stanley and Iris was not hugely, you know, talked about in the year that it came out in '89. It wasn't a big you know, awards
right.
you know, getter or anything like that. But it did pair together two great icons of movies in their own time together. In film, and I think that's worthy of discussion, you know. And I think Martin Ritt is worthy of discussion just in general, you know. my next one is somebody who only did one movie before this, before his film that made him really huge, and then he passed away, and it was such a shock. And that's Steve Gordon.
Yeah. And of course, the only movie he made was Arthur.
Oh, Uncle Peter! And Aunt Pearl!
Arthur, you're looking well.
Thank you. Oh, Aunt Pearl? May I say, you're looking younger every day. Doesn't Aunt Pearl look wonderful, darling?
She looks great.
Arthur, I don't think we've had the pleasure of meeting this young woman. Could you introduce us?
Oh, that's stupid of me. Princess Gloria, may I introduce my aunt and uncle, Peter and Pearl Bach?
How are you?
Princess? Did you say Princess Arthur?
Yes. There's a very small country in the West Indies. I mean, small.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. It's terribly small. Tiny little country. Rhode Island could beat the crap out of it in a war. That's how small it is.
It's small.
Very little. It's 85 cents in a cab from one end of the country to the other. I'm talking small.
We understand it's small, Arthur.
When that movie hit, I remember being a kid, you know, being a teenager and thinking, this guy is going to be huge. He is just going to be huge.
Well,
because
he wrote and directed that, and it was hysterical. That still remains one of my favorite comedies.
Oh yeah,
and,
it's a great film,
and it's got a lot of heart too. I mean, the courtesy of John Gielgud. You know, it's a great film, actually.
I mean, I've got a couple of other people like Charles Laughton who did Night of the Hunter, his only film. Or Leonard Castle, who only did The Honeymoon Killers in 1970. Leonard Castle was a musician, really, and he's the one that wrote and directed The Honeymoon Killers in 1970, which was going to be Martin Scorsese's debut film, but he actually got fired from... I think he got fired or let go or whatever. I don't know exactly what happened, but Leonard Castle, the writer... actually came in and directed the movie, and it actually became one of the movies that François Truffaut actually picked as one of his 10 favorite American films. And then we have Fred Zinnemann, whose last film was 5 Days, One Summer,
1982. That's on my list. That's on my list.
Which is one of the great Sean Connery performances. And it's about mountain climbing, and it's, you know, it's been years since I've seen it, to tell you the truth.
I think it's been like 20 years since I've seen it, so I don't remember much about it. I remember that came out about the time is Wrong is Right, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Another John Connery movie that...
Exactly. Yeah, almost, maybe even the same year. You know, I've got a Carl Dreyer's last movie, Gertrude, from '64, which is often picked as one of the great films, like in that sort of sight and sound kind of thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then now here's one that we all have something to say about: Sergio Leone's last Once Upon a Time in America.
And that wouldn't have been the last film. That's what's so sad about that. There was the great movie that he was going to make about the siege in Leningrad that never, and then there was another film about the American Civil War, I think, too. I mean, there are like two, and, you know, we haven't seen the final version of Once Upon a Time in America. That's what really, you know.
It's coming.
Every time I think I've watched the whole thing, then a couple of years later, oh, there's more footage. It's like a mad world. There's more footage. God forbid they find Berlin Alexander plots. There's more. Oh, this is an episode we never showed on German television.
It's going to be 18 hours now instead.
Well, I mean, that's one of those occasions where it's a very fitting final film. Especially since that was a movie that he dreamt about for so long and he finally got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, very tragically, it wasn't allowed to be released as he wanted it to be.
No, that's the second time that happened to him.
Which is definitely something that probably contributed to his death.
Yeah. I've got Louis Buñuel's last movie, That Obscure Object of Desire, from 1977.
Yeah. What a great last film.
What a great last movie that is! That whole sort of battle between, you know, Fernando Rey and the female in that movie.
Is that Carol Bouquet?
Yes, I couldn't remember her name. Sorry, thank you. But just a great final sort of. That's a great like sort of old man kind of movie.
Yeah, no, I watched that after 9/11. And what a crazy film and what an appropriate film to watch. I watched it, I guess, a couple months after 9/11 because there's a lot of terrorism like in that movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was on to something, that's for sure. I mean, not just about 9/11, but it really captured the mood of the time it was made and everything. It's a fascinating movie.
Okay, my next one is Joseph L. Mankiewicz's last film from 1972, Sleuth.
Yeah.
Which is also a great old man kind of movie because it's really about like an older, you know, genius writer battling a young punk.
And that was remade, wasn't it, with Jude Law?
With Kane in the Olivier role. Olivier was the older gentleman in the first movie, with Kane as the punk, and then later on it was Kane as the older writer, and then it was Jude Law?
Jude Law. Directed by Kenneth Branagh. Yep.
Yeah, right. That was it's an interesting remake. I mean, it's not a great film, but it's interesting, though.
It's stylish enough.
It's very stylish.
Yeah. But I love Sleuth from 72.
Oh, yeah, it's an awesome film.
Think of the perfect crime. The house is empty. Have you ever actually committed a crime before? Then go one step further.
This, as they say, is where the plot thickens.
It's a real game. And a real murder. There's absolutely no point in playing another pretend game. Isn't that right? Palomar Pictures International presents...
I understand you want to marry my wife.
With your permission, of course. Laurence Olivier.
You may not agree with this, Inspector, but you take it from me. The shortest way to a man's heart is through humiliation. You soon find out what he's made of.
Michael Caine.
Why don't I just keep tapping you lightly on the head with a poker until the lump comes up?
Can't make a game out of real murder.
We'll see. In Joseph L. Mankiewicz's film...
You're mad! You're a bloody mad!
You are a young man, dressed as a clown, about to be murdered.
Of Anthony Schaffer's Tony Award-winning play, Sleuth.
You actually put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger? As a game?
It's a very interesting movie for Mankiewicz to make, too, because, you know, it's so... It feels so British, you know, and it doesn't feel like the kind of movie that an American filmmaker should.
I'm sure he
would be making.
I'm sure he just probably saw it on the stage and said, you know, I'd like to make that into a movie, and did it that way. You know.
Well, he opened it up really well, and he actually got a Best Director nomination that year. Surprisingly so. I mean, he got two Best Actor nominations from the Oscars, and it actually got a Best Director nomination and I think a nomination for his score. But
you
sure
know what, I don't get them confused because I know what each movie is, but Sleuth is always synonymous to me with Death Trap. Maybe it's the whole mystery writer / Michael Caine connection.
Right.
And of course, Death Trap also came from a stage play, and it's a Sidney Lumet movie.
Right.
It all ties in.
It's a good stage play.
And I starred in Death Trap, actually. I did a theatrical production of it.
What part did you play?
The Christopher Reeve part.
Wow.
And the whole kind of slightly veiled gay subplot.
Yeah.
That was interesting to play. Yeah. With an old man I did it opposite an old man that was actually a closeted homosexual, and he was highly uncomfortable playing the gay moments in front of an audience.
Oh, interesting.
I finally decided we're not going to be married.
You never said we would be married.
No.
But you were quite right to come out. It was a good idea.
We're being awfully English about this, aren't we? I suppose that's all right.
As we are English. Yes, I suppose it is.
My next movie is David Lean's Passage to India. Which I still think is a great movie. I still think that it resonates. I don't think that it's a lesser David Lean movie. I think it's one of his greats. And it's really amazing to me too that he wasn't just the director and the writer and the producer, but he was also the editor of the movie. In fact,
That's how he got his start. I thought that was interesting.
He's one of the few people who's been nominated for 4 Oscars in 1 year for Passage to India. So, and plus that movie is so mysterious and weird.
What does she see in the caves? What the hell does she? What is it in the caves? What the hell? I don't know.
But I love
John Boehner. I mean, what the hell does she see in the caves?
John Boehner.
That movie keeps that mystery going, you know, and I like that. I like that choice. Okay, so now we're getting into my top 10, and here I would pick Robert Mulligan. This would be one of my most obscure ones. Robert Mulligan, the director of
To Kill a Mockingbird and The Other and Fear Strikes Out and so many other great movies. His last movie was The Man in the Moon from 1991,
yeah.
I think it was the debut performance by Reese Witherspoon, where she plays.
I think you're right.
Yeah. When she plays a young girl who falls in love with a farmhand who is killed tragically, and she has to get over that. That's a nice movie.
That got good reviews too. I'm trying to think. Was George Roy Hill's last movie Funny Farm?
Yes,
it was.
That is. I have that. I wrote that down on my one of these cards. Yeah.
Yes, it was.
A movie was acclaimed upon its release. Actually, critics really liked it, and I liked it too. And even rarer for a Chevy Chase movie to get good reviews around that time.
Yeah, it was already on the downward. We're already on the downward spiral there. I mean,
yeah.
So that was a good that and yeah that was a good film. I remember watching that. You know, rented on VHS.
What is the Chevy Chase movie where he snorts? The voodoo guy comes in because he's possessed and he snorts it.
Modern problems.
Like 83 or something. I remember that movie.
Before I think 80 or 81. Yeah, or 82
yeah.
maybe. I don't.
Dabney Coleman was in that too, right?
I always remember the commercials on HBO. Having him coming up after snorting the cocaine and going, I like it.
I love Debbie Coleman.
I always remember that. Okay, right. So one of the great, seriously, one of the great last movies. And I remember seeing this in the theater and thinking, oh my God, this has to be his last movie. It's just too perfect not to be his last movie. And that's Robert Altman's A Prairie Home Companion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a good movie. Very good movie.
Prairie Home Companion. You know, it definitely fit in his mold. I can't imagine another director being more apropos to do a rendition of Garrison Keillor's show than he was, because he's the as a director. I mean, he's the very definition of an ensemble guy.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he was, I mean, when he did Kansas City, he was very sick. And I think he got the heart transplant after Kansas City. And then Prairie Home Companion, they wouldn't insure him unless they had a backup director on set.
And that was P.T. Anderson.
Yeah, stayed with him all the way through. And P.T. Anderson, I'm sure, learned a lot from him being on set.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, all the talk of death and that with, you know, with Virginia Madsen as the angel of death in it, and just that incredible last scene in the diner, and with part of the cast, including Kevin Kline and Meryl Streep in there, and I just sat there, you know, just going, oh,
and it seemed completely unbelievable that Meryl Streep hadn't worked with Altman before that. I mean, they hadn't,
yeah.
had they? Yeah.
They
yeah.
had not, yeah.
Mm.
So it was amazing. Another of my favorite last movies is Louis Malle's Vanya on 42nd Street from 1994.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was his last, yeah, I remember, I saw that in the theater, actually, yeah.
That was just, again, you know, it was somewhat of a revisitation to another one of his great movies, My Dinner with Andre,
mm-hmm.
which also had Andre Gregory, and also included Wallace Shawn in it. It's just an amazing, amazing movie. I think that's also on Criterion as well.
Yeah.
Another Criterion selection that's on Criterion is Andrei Tarkovsky's last movie, The Sacrifice, from 1986, directed by Tarkovsky and photographed by Sven Nykvist. It is absolutely one of those movies that when I first saw it, I absolutely knew this is a movie about this is a movie made by somebody at the end of their life. You know, I just absolutely could feel it. It's one of those few movies, you know. And now we're getting into some
and watching Solaris, I felt like I was at the end of my life.
Well, I know that you're not a Tarkovsky fan, because you know I know that his movies are very, very slow.
Yeah, he's an acquired boredom, actually.
Yes, yeah, I understand that. I understand that, and that's brave of you to say that. But The Sacrifice is a really, really great movie, and actually, it's my favorite of Tarkovsky's movies. Then we get into Bergman. Bergman's last movie from 2003, Saraband.
Is that technically his last film? Because when you look on IMDb, there's something after that. I was looking earlier, and there's something after that, and I've never even heard of it.
Well, I'm going to look it up right now, but I'm pretty sure that's his last movie.
I saw something listed after that, Dean, and that's why I'm. But I was, yeah, definitely. That's a great film. I mean,
You might be looking at the writer thing.
That gets confusing. I would put director first. I hate when they do that, when they put, like, writer or producer. No, put director first.
That's the writer thing. You know, as a director, his last. Well, he did a TV movie called Spotkinson, which I don't know what that is.
I have no idea. I've never even heard of that.
Well, yeah. Saraband was a TV movie, too.
Yeah, Saraband
was
a TV movie.
But it was theatrically released, so, you know, that's why I put Saraband.
Well, you know, as was other TV movies that he did, yeah.
But Saraband is great. It's something that really feels like a last movie because it's a revisitation to those two characters that were in Scenes from a Marriage, played by Josephson and Liv Ullmann. Peter Yates is a separate piece from 2004. James Whale's They Dare Not Love from 1941. Robert Aldrich's All the Marbles from 1981.
And I wrote that down. I was like, oh, my God, that was his last movie. Oh, my God.
Yeah. John Cassavetes, Big Trouble, 1986.
Right.
Robert Wise's Rooftops from 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Leo McCarey's Satan Never Sleeps from 1962. Preston Sturges, The French, They Are a Funny Race, 1955. Eric von Stroheim's Hello Sister from 1933. D.W. Griffith's The Struggle, 1931. Antonioni's Beyond the Clouds with Wim Wenders, 1995.
Well, wait, is that his? What about the short film in Eros that he does, that anthology?
Well, I try and keep all the short films out of this. You know, I'm just trying to keep it to features. Carol Reed, The Public Eye, from 1972. Victoria De Sica's The Voyage, 1974. Jean Renoir's The Little Theater of Jean Renoir, 1970. Howard Hawks's Rio Lobo, 1970. Stanley Donen's Blame It on Rio, 1984.
Wow. Isn't he still alive?
He's still alive, but he's not making movies. Okay, Akira Kurosawa's Matadayo, 1983.
That's not that bad. That's an interesting.
1993. Yeah.
That's not a bad film, though. I'm not saying
that these are bad movies, but I'm just saying that they are lesser movies.
I thought Rhapsody in August was his last movie.
No, he made another one.
I thought that, too. Charlotte Chaplin's The Countess from Hong Kong, 1967. François Truffaut's Confidentially Yours, 1983. Billy Wilder's Buddy Buddy, 1981.
That is the one. Okay.
Yep.
This is now one of the greatest filmmakers who ever lived. He makes really one bad film. One bad film. And cannot get another gig?
Yeah.
This is very serious. This guy makes one bad film. I mean, I'm not saying Fedora and the other ones before that are masterpieces, but this is the one you're gonna crucify this guy for this movie. You're out of your mind. That was one of the greatest injustices ever done.
Yeah,
in
a
different era. I mean, a different era of people that took over Hollywood that didn't care about the old Hollywood.
Right, exactly.
They didn't value the knowledge that they had or what they could gain from them. They just wanted to pave their own way, and they kind of elbowed them out, you know.
Well, they sort of made an example out of him. They made him the poster boy,
they did.
Almost.
Exactly, they did. It's so true. That's exactly right.
And he wanted to make movies. He wanted to make movies still. I mean, there are tons of movies left in him.
Yeah. That's one of the saddest examples of this. Hal Ashby, 8 Million Ways to Die.
But I'm notable for Andy Garcia, though, for whatever that's worth today.
Yeah, he's
good
in it, yeah.
What I always wanted, and that'll never happen, and... I always wanted to see what his director's cut would have been of 8 Million Ways to Die, because he didn't get to touch that movie really in editing. And the thing that shocks me about executives and studios and their misuse of Hal Ashby was they didn't value his post-production sense. They just saw the way he shot movies, and they thought it was very lackadaisical, that no one was going on a script. And Mark Damon, who produced 8 Million Ways to Die and who was a guest on the show, there was a lot of bad blood between Mark Damon and Hal Ashby. He decided to give Ashby a chance after years of drug abuse and bad stories from the sets of Ashby movies about his behavior. He decided to give him a chance on 8 Million Ways to Die. He had an Oliver Stone script. They had Robert Towne come in and do rewrites. So he had the two most electrifying screenwriters in the business that worked on the script. Then he'd go to the set, and Hal Ashby wasn't shooting the script. He was letting actors kind of find their way and improvise scenes and all this kind of stuff. And Mark Damon, as somebody that was a penny pincher and a producer on the project, really didn't like that at all. And he'd find Hal Ashby smoking weed and that kind of stuff. But the actors adored him. Like Andy Garcia and Roseanne Arquette and Jeff Bridges, they all went to bat for him.
Where is Sarah? You don't make the rules here today, baby.
Jeff Bridges, star of Jagged Edge and Starman.
You're going to blow the deal, man.
Roseanne Arquette, star of Desperately Seeking Susan and Silverado.
You got Sonny killed.
They're in trouble. In love.
For a half-assed hooker, you're an extremely arrogant woman, you know that?
And in way over their heads. It's murder, prostitution, drugs, and passion. Announcing the video cassette release of a sensational detective thriller.
Now get alone!
What?
Won't we love you, baby?
Anything can happen when there's 8 million ways to die.
Actually, that scene in The Big Lebowski when Jeff Bridges and John Goodman go up to throw Donnie's ashes to the ocean, and the ashes like fly back in Jeff Bridges' face. That's in that movie because that happened to Jeff Bridges. Jeff Bridges went out with friends with Hal Ashby's ashes out in the ocean and threw the ashes, and they flew back at everyone's face. And it was almost like, yeah, that's something Hal would do. It's like at the very, you know. And I'm really, you know, there's the great story of Looking to Get Out, which we covered, which was another film that got taken from him. And he secretly made a director's cut and gave it to UCLA. And then it was unearthed and they premiered it and released it on DVD finally. A much better film. I mean, the studios came in and absolutely massacred a lot of his latter stuff.
Right.
But also, he was extremely self-destructive.
Yeah.
And he kind of destroyed himself in a lot of ways. And the movies reflected that. I mean, The Slugger's Wife and that kind of stuff. You think, God, Hal, what are you doing after such a breakthrough of films in the 70s? And also, and one of his most famous films, Shampoo, he didn't even really direct that. I mean, Warren Beatty kind of took that one over.
Right, yeah.
He just sat on the sidelines.
Right. Yeah.
You know who he originally wanted to star in Harold and Maude? Who he approached for Harold and Maude?
Who?
Elton John. He wanted Elton John to play the male lead in that.
And that would have changed movie history.
Elton John absolutely wanted to do it, but his music career was just taking off. So he said, "I got to do this music thing. I got to follow this through." Yeah.
Wow.
That would have changed movie history, if you ask me.
And when he died, he died like a liver cancer or something. The person that recognized that and took him to the hospital the first time was Warren Beatty, and he blamed Warren Beatty for a surgery that he felt got botched that led to his quick death. And he never talked to Warren Beatty again. They were on the outs near the end. But.
And it's just the whole thing is too
tragic.
Yeah. It's too ridiculously sad. Okay, so here's some other names here who, you know, did movies that didn't hit. William Wyler. The Liberation of L.B. Jones.
I don't even remember this movie. I was looking, researching that earlier, and I was like, what? I know the title. I've never seen it.
I've never seen it either. John Frankenheimer, technically his last big screen movie was Reindeer Games with Ben Affleck in 2000. But he did a TV movie. He hopped back and forth between TV and
but the TV movie is actually very.
Was that Past the War?
Yeah. That's a superb movie. That was
Michael
great.
Gambon as Lyndon Johnson.
As LBJ,
exactly. So, that's an interesting sort of like split there in some ways. John Hughes' last movie was Curly Sue, 1991. Lucio Fulci's Door to Silence, 1991. Nicholas Ray's We Can't Go Home Again, 1976, which I saw at the New York Film Festival, and I said, oh, my God, this is terrible. I can't even sit.
What is that about, by the way? What is that about, Dean?
It's really just him. It's really kind of strange to say that it's his last movie because he was teaching at an upstate New York university. And he gave the cameras over to his charges, and they filmed the movie, and he really sort of edited it together into some kind of mess that some people have good things to say about it. I can't have anything good to say about it at all.
Okay, all right. But
anyone who wants to watch a great Nicholas Ray movie, Criterion's Bigger Than Life. It's
Bigger Than Life. Yeah. That's maybe my favorite.
You know what? I think I saw... was it Wim Wenders that did a movie about Nicholas Ray? It's a Wim Wenders movie. It's a documentary. And Nicholas Ray is dying.
Okay.
And he's sitting there, and he's like, oh, my God, I'm so sick. And he is in the process of dying. That movie captures that.
Jesus Christ, I'm sick. I don't know why. I have to go now. Huh? Ah, man. Okay, I'm finished. All right? What are you going to do?
Say cut.
Go ahead.
You say cut.
Go ahead, cut. Cut. Go ahead, cut. Go on, cut.
That might be one and only time that's been captured, something like that. The last one, Bob Fosse, Star 80, 1983. You know, I mean, of course he wasn't expecting to die of a heart attack, even though he kind of predicted it with all that jazz. But with Star 80, you know, you get the true sense of his sort of disgust and his fascination with all of the glamorous and all of the most horrific things about stardom.
I have this feeling about Dorothy. She's going to be a big star.
They're going to give me $10,000 for having my picture taken.
Dorothy is every man's fantasy.
Sit down.
Dorothy, just can't let him do this to you.
You want her, pal? You can have her. But you're going to have to pay.
You know, when he passed away, I remember being in, I was working at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution as a copy boy, actually. and I was there. I was there to bring photos from that were coming over the wire to the editors of the newspaper at the time, and that was just one of the things I had to do. And I still remember the photo of Bob Fosse coming over the wire. And I said, oh, my God, Bob Fosse is gone. You know, I can still feel it, you know.
Yeah, Fosse was amazing. And Star 80 is a tough movie, and it's as tough as any other movie that he made.
The next one, Krzysztof Kieślowski's Three Colors Red.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's, yeah, that's definitely.
I mean, that's insane to think that that was his last film, because that was the movie that really, that and the other two films in the Three Colors you know, trilogy were the movies that really broke him, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
People really knew his name right at the end of his career, you know. But my very favorite movie, my very favorite last film, the one that's absolutely perfect, that's absolutely the one, is John Huston's The Dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good choice. It's a very good choice.
If you look at The Dead, you know, and you just feel all the emotion, you know.
Well, it's made by a man
family.
Who knows. It's made by a man who knows he's reaching the end. I mean, that's that's the feeling you get of the movie. It's meant to be his swan song, and it's one of the few out of any of the directors that we mentioned that actually their last movie actually is that. Yeah, it's their last
right.
movie because they can't they won't live anymore, and they know it. Yeah. Well, good. I'm so glad we ended the show at a good note.
Yeah. I have a question. We mentioned Family Plot.
No, we didn't. But yeah, I mean, we mentioned Hitchcock and Family Plot this interview. But Hitchcock is amazing to me because, and what I talked to Nat about is the need to stay relevant as you get older. That never applied more to me than with Hitchcock. Because people were trying to exceed him at his own game. I mean, he invented the rules, and then everyone else took it and ran with it. And meanwhile, he's an old guy, and he's, you know, so it's interesting. But the frenzy was daring in a lot of ways. But then Family Plot, and I tried to watch that just a couple of weeks ago. And
it doesn't.
No.
It doesn't fly.
No.
I watched it 12 years ago. I found it very charming. It's a very charming movie.
And unless Cary Grant's in a Hitchcock movie, I'm not looking for charming.
It's not a bad. It's a Bruce Dern's good Karen Black. I mean, it's not a bad movie.
I just watched it 2 weeks ago.
Give it another chance. It's not a bad movie. I actually like that movie quite a bit.
I mean, you watched it 12 years ago. I watched it 2 weeks ago. So you need to give it a chance before I do. But
you know,
but it actually plays like a TV movie for me.
It does. It has a big TV movie feel to it, and that's the thing that's a big minus to me. It's just not visual enough for me. But I mean, I want to mention, you know, a couple of other things.
Frenzy would have been a good movie to go out with, actually.
That would have been the best one. Frank Capra's Pocketful of Miracles, Alan Pacquiao's The Devil's Own, John Ford's Seven Women.
The Devil's Own is not good. That's a bad.
Yeah,
he died
also,
a horrible accident.
Yeah,
so
it's
horrible.
Not a good way to go out. But
and also,
I
mean, a movie that really tortured him. You know, it was a torturous shoot, that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know because we talked to the screenwriter for our Picoult tribute.
Yeah. But you got John Ford's Seven Women, Sergei Einstein's. Ivan the Terrible Part 1 and Ivan the Terrible Part 2 didn't come out until 58, 10 years after his death. Michael Powell's Age of Consent from 69. Federico Fellini's Inter Vista, which really isn't his last movie. His last movie was The Voice of the Moon, which I've never even heard of.
I never heard of that one.
George Cukor's Rich and Famous from 81. Robert Bresson's Largent from 83.
James Bridges, Bright Lights, Big City, which I know is talked about in the book. Stanley Kramer's The Runner Stumbles, Nora Ephron's Julie and Julia, then Sam Peckinpah's The Osterman Weekend.
Which was interesting because he got that came about from Don Siegel's last film, Jinx.
Yeah.
Because Sam Peckinpah couldn't get work anywhere, and Don Siegel let him do second unit work for Jinx, and that led to the Osterman Weekend.
Actually, Jerry, did you have movies on your list that we have mentioned?
No, we talked about it. We talked about a couple of them. There's another one besides Alan. These aren't ones I necessarily like or anything. Just I wrote down. There's like Claude Chabrol's Inspector Bellamy, which was a couple of years ago. That was with Gerard Depardieu. There's a picture of Gerard Depardieu in New York Magazine this week, and at first I thought it was Lena Dunham. So keep that in mind. Just keep that in mind. There's Sidney Pollack's The Interpreter, Tony Richardson's The Blue Sky, John Sturges.
Which is actually okay. I like that.
Yeah, John Sturges. The Eagle Has Landed, and he made The Great Escape, all these great action movies. He ended on a high note, The Eagle Has Landed. Great, better book than movie, but still, George Hickenlooper, Casino Jack.
Isn't it Blue Skies, the Jessica Lange?
Blue Skies. And let me see, this Anthony Minghella is Breaking and Entering, which I wasn't crazy about, but with Jude Law. And I guess, does this count last feature film, Blake Edwards, Son of the Pink Panther?
Oh, boy, I guess that counts.
Yeah. And the other one is actually is Kinji Fukasato's, who did all the great Japanese gangster movies, but he did Battle Royale, and Battle Royale 2 was his last film that his son completed for him. Those are just some that I had on there.
Okay, the last films of great directors. All right, we close off tonight with a piece of film score. John Debney from the new movie The Call, starring Halle Berry.
Oh, wow, okay.
Will this be the last score from a great composer?
Oh, God, okay, all right.
That's terrible.
You are awful.
All right, we'll be back next week with director Susan Seidelman, one of the great independent filmmakers of the 80s, was Desperately Seeking Susan and Cookie and Making Mr. Right and all kinds of great stuff.
I love Making Mr. Right.
Yeah, she's got a new movie out called Musical Chair. She's going to talk to us about that. Actually, I'm in love with this conversation. It was a great time talking to her. And also,
it's a very good movie, too.
Yeah, it is. And also, we'll be talking to Glenn Frankel. He's written a new book on the making of The Searchers, the John Ford classic, and another conversation I'm crazy about. So next week will be a great show. We hope you'll join us then. Thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you.